Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shaped the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
Welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. It's good to have you with us. My name is Ryan Ballingy. Check us out on our website, golfnewsnet.com. Email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/golfnewsnet or @golfnewsnet on Twitter and @RyanBallingy on Twitter. The topic of this week's show is Donald Trump. And you might be wondering why in the world I'm going to talk about Donald Trump, but in case you haven't heard, he purchased the Doral Resort just outside of Miami, Florida, not too long ago, and has spent really the last 16 to 18 months renovating the joint and put a lot of money into the place, including hiring renowned golf course architect Gil Hance to come in and redesign one of the resort's courses, which is the TPC Blue Monster. And the new Blue Monster, which will be played in 3 weeks for the WGC Cadillac Championship at Doral, was unveiled to the public this week. And there was a lot of fanfare about it. Golf Channel brought its morning drive program to Doral to broadcast live from site to do interviews with Donald Trump, as well as golf course architect Gil Hance, as well as a number of the staffers between the Doral Resort, which has been renovated significantly, as well as the WGC Cadillac Championship Tournament. And there's a lot of fanfare to be deserved. Gil Hance did a great job. The course looks wonderful, as best I can tell. It seems like a big improvement from where it was. But the heart of the conversation here isn't about the quality of the work that's done by Donald Trump, by Gil Hance, whose kids Donald Trump is putting through college. None of that is in question. I think that anybody who observes the work that Donald Trump pays for and has done, whether by Hance or anybody else that he employs, is typically top-grade stuff. He comes in when he buys properties and really transforms them and makes them top-notch facilities. Whether you have an affinity for his business model or have an affinity for how Mr. Trump acts personally, that's not to say. That's not part of this discussion. But I think that a lot of the conversation in this week, especially around Doral, is about the golf course, but it's also about Donald Trump, and it's about his role in the game, and it's about the kind of golf ambassador that he is. And it's undeniable the kind of impact that he's had on the game. You can't really even deny that it's positive impact. He's taken a number of facilities, and many of them in blight, bought them at a cutthroat price, turned them around, spit-shined them, and then has repackaged them as facilities that they are better than what he bought them for. And Doral is just the latest. And it seems like it may have never been a better place to be. And unfortunately, that comes with a premium, and that's typically how Trump makes his money back. He charges a premium to either be a member or to play the facilities. I mean, really, Doral is the first truly, and is not even truly, somewhat public facility that Trump has trumpeted. And I think that in part, that kind of dampers his impact on the game and his role as an ambassador. But golf fully embraces the guy, and he had a very nice panel discussion at the PGA Merchandise Show, where he was a part of it, with Ted Bishop and some others within the industry, considered an industry leader because of his position in buying Doral, buying a number of high-end country clubs, and making them even higher-end country clubs. And I think that we need to step back from looking at Donald Trump as a great ambassador for the game of golf so much as one that's great for the high end of golf. The kind of guy that can come in and take a sport's high end, which has kind of been getting smaller and crumbling a little bit, and maybe expand its boundaries a little bit down. Because the small to middle country club is hurting in this country. And I'm not saying that you're supposed to cry for all of them, but that's the truth. So the country club model is hurting a little bit. Not that there isn't a desire, I don't think, for people to feel like they have an upscale experience, but that the experience people get isn't matching their expectations of what they are going to spend and what they're going to get. So Trump has obviously recognized an opportunity here and come into a number of clubs around the country, purchased them, like I said, at a very cheap rate, renovated them in some capacity, either course, facilities, or both. Basically reset the membership model and is offering this to folks who have the money and the means to do it. It's great. But here's the thing. Donald Trump isn't doing anything to increase public play, to increase participation among juniors, or at least juniors that don't have a silver spoon in their mouth. And he's not building golf courses that are... you're not going to get a Donald Trump Muni all of a sudden. It's not going to be Donald Trump Bartholomew Park in New Orleans, for example, or the course that I grew up on, Donald Trump Carroll Park, 12-hole course turned back into 9, then back into 12 in Baltimore City in Maryland. And so I think that we have to look at Trump and evaluate his position within the game appropriately, because a lot of the conversation in the game right now, and Ted Bishop talked about this with our friend Matt Adams on his show, Fairways of Life, on SiriusXM this week, where he said that the talk of the PGA show was bifurcation. And maybe that's true to an extent, but I think of bifurcation in a couple of different senses. One, as we've talked about on this show, and I've written many times in the past about, two senses of the rules of golf. One for the highest level of player and one for everybody else. And that's true. But there's also another kind of bifurcation in the game of golf, and that is by class. And I'm not trying to turn this into a class welfare argument. By no stretch am I trying to do that. But Donald Trump is operating in a different golf class than most people are in this country. Of the 26 million Americans who play golf, or whatever that number is these days that we're guessing, I would tell you that most of them do not belong to country clubs. Most of them certainly don't belong to high-end country clubs. Most of them are a daily fee player. They go to a course where they walk up, they slap their money down, say, I want to play. And those folks are struggling. And we talked about it a couple weeks ago, or last week in the show, where we were talking about hack golf and the idea that maybe having more golfers isn't the best idea in the world, but that we're trying to convert the existing golfers into golfers that spend more time on the course and therefore spend money on the course, and in the course of that, spend more money in the game of golf. And there's an oversupply of golf courses in this country, and we've talked about that too. And that's kind of my personal conundrum here, is that I certainly admire what Trump is doing as a businessman, as a golfer, as a golf fanatic. I think what he's doing is pretty outstanding. It's very shrewd and savvy. But it doesn't necessarily alter the course of the game's participation rate, or if you accept my notion that we don't need to hike participation, we need to hike the number of core golfers, it still doesn't fit that standard either. And so what is he really accomplishing here, other than helping a very small subset of people in this country play golf at a very nice facility? So I want to talk about the conundrum that I have with that, which is I think guys like Donald Trump would be even better for the sport of golf if they went so far as to invest money in the municipal / semi-private / affordable portion of the game. That would be outstanding, I think, because it would jazz up courses that have either been fallen on hard times or just look downright in blight, and communities would rally around that and maybe bring some return business and folks who have lapsed as golfers who have walked away from the game back into it because they see what the possibilities are to play on a great property again. And I'm pretty well convinced at this point that there are probably thousands of courses, thousands of courses in this country where that's happened, where for whatever reason, the mom-and-pop operator, whoever is running it, the owner, has allowed the course to kind of fall off of what it once was. And the people who used to play it, typically community-based, because obviously with 16,000 golf facilities in this country, not every one of them is a really nice resort or country club. So the people who in the community play those courses just kind of walk away because they don't want to have a substandard experience. And rather than go find a new home course, maybe they just don't play as often. And maybe they go play somewhere else every now and then, but it's not as convenient, so they just don't play as much. And And there they go. They're out of the either core golfer category or even the casual category, and all of a sudden they're a lapsed player. And at the same time, a number of those courses just kind of need to go away. 16,000 golf courses in this country is far too many for 26 million golfers. There needs to be closer to 14,000 courses in this country. So that means where we're at right now, we're losing between 100 and 200 facilities a year, depending on the kind of year that we're having as a golf industry. We're at least a decade away from getting to that probably ideal number of facilities in the U.S. where supply meets demand. So courses still have to close. Trump's still got to do his thing on the high end. So who deals with the 14,000 courses that are probably going to survive this whole thing, that aren't high-end, that aren't country clubs? So, what, 12 to 13,000 of them, let's say. Who's going to be the person that stewards those back to the standard from which they were built and into the future of the game of golf, where we're not going to have 30 million players, we're probably going to have 23 to 25 million players, and hopefully if all of this stuff we've been talking about growing the game goes right and somebody figures it out, then many more of them will play more golf, and they're going to be looking for a good experience at a decent price. And Donald Trump's not the guy to give that to them. He's never going to be that guy, and I'm not asking him to be that guy. I mean, it would be great for the game, but that's not who he is, and that's not where his money's at. So for as good as he is at the high end, and as good as maybe even as a spokesman as he is for the game of golf, taking his brand of everything being the best thing you've ever seen, and including that in golf in that conversation or that talking point, yeah, that's good. There's nothing wrong with that, I guess. But he's not doing for the average golfer what he's doing for the high-end golfer. So I don't know the answer to the question. I just kind of pose it out there. What is Donald Trump's worth to the game at large if all he's doing is taking properties, once proud properties, once prestigious properties, in blight, buying them at a cheap cost, renovating them, and hiking the fees that go along with the services he provides at one of his facilities? It's the same thing he did in the casino industry, and again, I have no problem with any of it. I may disagree with the guy on literally every point of contention when it comes to politics, but what he's doing for the game of golf is something to be admired as a businessman. So that kind of dovetails into this, again, the conversation about growing the game and participation. There isn't going to be a patron saint of the muni golfer. There isn't going to be a patron saint of the daily fee player. That's not going to happen. That savior is not waiting. Jack Nicklaus designs courses. He doesn't run them. Arnold Palmer designs and runs courses, but he doesn't tend to do low end. He does higher end too. That's where the money's at. And that's why companies like Billy Casper Golf, which again, in full disclosure, is my employer, are important. Because they're going to be the ones that apply the practices that need to be applied to property so that they run not only profitably, but in a way that delivers a high-quality experience to the average golfer. And so I think you're going to see this over the next decade as we continue to lose supply. The surviving courses are the ones that are differentiated in some meaningful way. It may not be drastic, but meaningful way from their competition. They'll survive, but then they'll cannibalize each other to an extent, and the need for professional management will grow even larger. It's a trend I'm just expecting to happen, and that's not because I get paychecks from them. It's because it's the truth. And so I'm very curious to see how that will happen over time and whether or not you and I, the average golfer, will benefit or will where it will leave us in the end, because golf is not getting any less expensive to play. But in the meantime, economically speaking, you and I in this country are getting relatively poorer compared to the richest folks in this country. The amount of money concentrated at the top of the pay scale, at the top of the food chain in this country, is way different than it used to be in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And it really started to change in the 90s and 2000s, but the drastic change is here, and it should be in front of your face that we're not really, the average middle class American, not on the against inflation, making really any more than we made 20 years ago. Meanwhile, the folks at the very, very top who are doing very, very well are taking a larger share of money than ever, which is why Donald Trump is in that high-end business to begin with, because there is a lot of money there. And on top of all that, he only has to appeal to a much smaller audience than someone like a Billy Casper Golf, which deals with largely middle to upper middle class folks. There are plenty more of those folks in this country than rich people, but the money isn't even close. And so it's a really interesting time to be a golf marketer because and be in the golf business, I think. Because you have to confront a reality here that the middle class is shrinking. Whether you want to agree with that as a political talking point or not, as it's economically defined, that's true. The middle class is smaller than it's been in 50 years. And so what we have to acknowledge as an industry is that people have tighter wallets than they may have had 20 years ago when the golf boom began, which was talked about at the PGA merchandise show. So they have less percentage of their total money to spend on golf, which means we need to make golf more affordable, but at the same time, with the remaining courses that are left, offer a top-notch experience, valuable to the golfer, worth more, really, than what they're paying for it, at least in their mind. That's a tough thing to do, and that is a long-term issue we're going to have to deal with, because courses want to stay afloat. They want you to come and play once, and they want you to come and play again, because so few players go to a golf property and play repeatedly. That's just kind of how the numbers bear out. About two-thirds of people who ever play around at a facility will never come back to that facility, either because they're visiting or because they didn't like it enough or because they quit the game. There's a lot of reasons why, but that just kind of seems to be the number. And I think part of that, and obviously this would be borne out if we did a large survey, but I think it comes down to value. What's the value of your time? 5 to 6 hours of your time, because we don't play fast enough. 5 to 6 hours of your time on a weekend or whenever you get a spare minute to play at a course that's pretty good but not great, and to pay a little bit too much for what you think you're getting back in return. And that pretty much right there encapsulates why golf is shrinking. It's not that golf isn't necessarily fun in and of itself, but like football, there's very little actual golf action in golf. So golf's fun. The social aspect is fun. Waiting isn't. Paying too much isn't. Not getting enough isn't. So all of those things kind of outweigh the benefits of the actual action of the game of golf and the social component. So we got to change that. And that is really what's at the core of the issue here, is the value proposition of golf. To me, it's always been the same. It's never going to change. I'm always going to look for the occasional high-end opportunity, but for by and large, and even at a golf club that is very, very middle class, I'm looking for value. I'm looking to play pretty quickly. I'm looking for it to fit my busy schedule. I'm looking for it to be a good time, but it doesn't have to be an extraordinary time, and to feel like I accomplished something out there. I think that's what a lot of golfers want, and that's why they play. And a lot of courses don't deliver that, and that's why they fail. For whatever, I mean, there are plenty of reasons why they wouldn't or can't deliver it, but that's why they fail. So, you know, I have this kind of fascination with the topic of growing the game of golf and whether or not we should even bother. And it got spurred all over again by Donald Trump. And the guy's very bombastic and very subject to these exorbitant promises and a lot of hyperbole. But the guy's done a really good job with what he's worked with in this industry. So I'm not here to bash Donald Trump. I'm not going to. But there needs to be a Donald Trump for the average golfer. And as I've said, I just don't think that's going to come. That's a disappointing thing to realize, I think, because of the wonderful grandeur that goes on around this property, this Doral property this week, from not only Golf Channel, who has a nice relationship with Donald Trump. Obviously, they used to air a Donald Trump show on their network. But also the print media as well. Golf Week was there. PGAtour.com is there. Pretty much every major media outlet has somebody there for this opening because it's a big deal. But you know what's also a big deal? When a golf course in Virginia that's been around for 30 or 40 years finally decides they're going to tack on another 9 holes and complete the golf course and make it a full 18. Or a property invests back in their greens to make them better for the long run experience. There's a lot of that happening, but there's not a lot of recognition that it's happening, if that makes sense. And it deserves recognition just as much as Donald Trump pouring 9 figures into Doral to make it better, to make it world class, to make it a beacon of luxury golf and luxury treatment to the people who can afford it. That's not going to happen. Maybe I'll be able to tout that to some extent, especially in my role with Billy Casper Golf, but there are not going to be a whole lot of people like me doing that. And so I think that that's kind of the rut we're in here, that golf doesn't necessarily really appreciate the middle-class golfer, primarily because it's easier to market to a upper-class golfer. And so the challenge for the golf industry, among a lot, with this hack golf idea and the idea to make the game of golf more fun, it's not only a matter of fun. It's a matter of affordability. It's a matter of providing value. And it starts with the golf experience, the golf round. It starts with the golf equipment, because there is no Chevrolet for golf equipment that needs to exist. And there needs to be a way to really communicate to people just what they're getting for a round of golf, and for the consumer, frankly, to communicate to the golf facilities themselves in mass and not with just their wallet what they're not getting right. And if we can do all of those things together, then I think we have a chance to really connect with the golfer as a business and to do good things by them, for them, with them, and allow this game not necessarily to grow. I'm not talking about growing golf at this point. I think you've got my thesis statement. I'm not trying for millions and millions and millions more golfers. I'm trying to make happy the people we've still got playing the game of golf. And if we can do that, and the vast majority of them kind of fit into this middle class to upper middle class boat, then the Titanic doesn't sink and it actually makes its journey. And we're all a little bit better off for it. And I'd be very curious to hear your thoughts about it. I would love to hear your perspective on value in golf, whether you feel you're getting it or not, and whether or not you feel like we should be trumpeting a guy like Donald Trump, who's making incredible investments in the game, but not necessarily in a way that impacts the way you play. So email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Check us out on our website, golfnewsnet.com. Follow me on Twitter, @RyanBallingy. Find Golf News Net on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/golfnewsnet. Until next week, I'm Ryan Balaji saying thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shaped the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
Hey, Central Ohio. The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's C-O-T-A.com. Good luck to all the runners.
Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.